Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Actually got a couple of visitors to the studio. If you're watching on Facebook, we're going to just quickly say hello to Julian and Kathy Joshua. And they are my constituents from Alexandria and frequent listeners. And who knows, they may have a comment on today's show. I've been thinking about the kids that are separated from their parents at the border, including... This is important. Not just kids that come over unlawfully with their parents crossing the border, but families seeking asylum, refugees, same kind of people as, well, I don't know, the pilgrims, you might say, or Jews escaping the Holocaust, or any of the other millions of refugees who came to this country to seek a better life, legally, by the way, because we have a law based on international law after the Holocaust that says we will check asylum seekers to see if they have a lawful claim of persecution or abuse. And as you know, it is now our policy, our government policy, official policy put forward by Attorney General Jeff Sessions and others in the Trump administration to forcibly separate parents from children as a way to encourage them not to come to this country. The Homeland Security Advisor, John Kelly, talked about it that way. It's not working as a deterrent. We actually have more people apprehended than ever. More people are coming to our borders than ever because times are bad and people try to escape poverty and abuse. And there are parents who make the Sophie's choice, I guess, of saying that they'd rather have their kids be alive, even if they can't be with them, than to be killed. But is this what America's about? You know, to this day, we talk about the detention camps in World War II for Japanese Americans. And those were horrible times and things that America has officially apologized for, things that we thought we would never see again. And even in those camps, parents were allowed to be with their children. I see this lack of compassion, well, all over America. I see it, obviously, in the burgeoning Me Too movement, which, let's face it, is simply calling attention to the way things have been for centuries, millennia, really, when it comes to human beings. I'm glad the Me Too movement is making it clear. But I want to talk this hour about survivors of abuse. And it could be sexual abuse, could be domestic violence, could be running, fleeing from oppression. But when do we have compassion for these people and when don't we? What we hear time and time again from survivors of sexual abuse all across the country, all over the world, survivors of domestic violence, yes, even in my own district, even in my own district, even in my liberal corner of Virginia that I represent in the Virginia House of Delegates, I have constituents coming to me telling me, I went to the police. They didn't take my claim seriously. I didn't tell anyone because I knew I could lose my children. And there are cases in Fairfax County, just next door to where I represent, where judges have been taking kids away from women who dare to complain that they've been beaten up, sexually abused, who dare to complain about child abuse. There's actually a growing problem that I'm working on in the Virginia state legislature where we have families that are torn apart by child abuse, domestic violence, and sexual violence, and the judges seem more concerned that mom is saying bad stuff about dad than actually examining whether mom indeed was raped, beaten up, abused. Where does the lack of compassion come from? And I can give you other cases, local cases, and part of this is local because one of the things about being a state delegate is I do have people come to me, vulnerable people, people in need. And it could be an immigrant. It could be someone who's a survivor. It could be, and this is a cases that I've been working on just recently with two, one's a constituent, one's not, but two really wonderful groups of people who've come to me about guardian abuse. Now, this is never discussed, but let me give you the example. It's really troubling. There are cases all across America, and yes, in Virginia, but it's in every state that I've seen, where you have an elderly person, and they're suffering some form of dementia, that probably Alzheimer's is the most common case, where people lose their mental faculties. And so people have to have guardians appointed for them to take care of them. And that part makes sense. Obviously, if you have Alzheimer's dementia to a certain degree, you can't take care of yourself. But what we're finding is that guardians appointed by courts with no connection to families are going in there and they're making a ton of money off their wards. Now, again, in and of itself, I understand that. They have to be paid. But the thing that I'm complaining about is that these guardians are increasingly not letting family members visit their loved ones. And even more so when family members complain of abuse the Alzheimer's patient, mistreating them, not treating them right, them being in pain or suffering or being dehydrated, then what do these guardians do? They cut off visitation with the family. And it's very understandable why they're doing it, right? They get paid to watch these people. Family members are complaining. And rather than change the practices and treat people more compassionately, more humanely, what are they doing? They're cutting off visitation. And that way, well, the problem can't be seen. And again, I think this all wraps in. I look at Senator Jeff Merkley, wonderful Democratic senator from Oregon, who strived really hard to get into one of these centers. One of these centers is apparently an abandoned strip mall, this large room where apparently, I've been told, some 11,000 children are being held, an enormous number of children in a facility not made for children. And, well, Senator Merkley, a United States senator, wanted to go in and make sure they're being fed, right? They're getting health care, making sure they have beds. We've seen examples where these kids who've been forcibly separated from their parents are placed in tent cities and sleeping on the ground. You know, I mean, we hear of awful things happening to refugees in Syria, and that's terrible. But in the United States, we're doing this? Think of the trauma. Think of the trauma of a child, a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 12-year-old, who is in danger in their home country of El Salvador or wherever it is they're suffering gangs or persecution. They come here with their parents to seek a better life, and now their parents are 1,000 miles away, and they can't talk with them, and they have no one, maybe, hopefully, a sibling. Hopefully, they have a brother or sister, because if they don't, they'll be bedded with some other child they don't know. They may not even speak the same language. Think of the horror. No, I'm not going to compare it, at least not one for one, apples to apples, to concentration camps and things like that. But it's on the way there. I mean, we're not killing these kids. But at the same point, we are psychologically destroying their lives. We are taking them, and I just can't imagine all the therapy it's going to take to try to heal after the incredible post-traumatic stress that we're putting on these children. And then, if some of them commit crimes, can we really be surprised? To what extent did our mistreatment cause people to commit crimes? The irony is that before Trump, we know that immigrants, whether documented or not, commit crimes at a far lesser rate than American citizens. But I wouldn't be surprised if after our mistreatment, the numbers go up. So my overall topic today is all of this mistreatment of innocent people, right? These kids are innocent people. Victims of sexual violence, domestic violence, child abuse, they are all innocent people. You know, if you get mugged outside a grocery store and someone holds you at gunpoint and takes your wallet, that's a traumatic thing, no question about it. And you go in and you go to the police and you tell them your story, you're going to get a lot of attention and support. I'm so sorry, sir, that happened to you. I'm so sorry, ma'am. What did the perpetrator look like? When did it happen? What time? You know, that's awful. You need a glass of water. You know, but you get treated seriously. Now take a victim of sexual assault. She comes in. She's probably even more hysterical, or a male victim, even more hysterical than someone who suffered from a mugging, because obviously a rape is a very invasive thing. It's even worse than a mugging. And it just seems that, and I keep hearing stories that the police are saying almost accusatory questions. Well, what were you drinking? And why were you out that late? And why were you wearing that outfit, that sexually revealing outfit? As if women have no right to drink or be out at 2 a.m. or to wear a revealing outfit. You know, just because you wear something that you think makes you look sexy is not an invitation to rape. It never has been. It never will be. People have a right to dress up and look nice. But the accusations are very different from a mugging. And this stigma encourages people not to speak out. And I guess what I want to know is, where is the compassion? Where is that moment where people separate themselves, where they say, oh, those kids from a foreign country, well, they're not me. Or that woman, maybe I'm a man, I won't be sexually assaulted. Of course, it does happen to men. But, you know, I'm not going to be in that situation. What causes us to relate to people and not relate to people? Where's the compassion? And how much is this president and his ilk causing compassion to drain away in this country? 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. I'll be right back right after this.
He's a Fulbright scholar and he speaks French, but he couldn't tell you who won the Super Bowl. It's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275.
Back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I guess I was just showing off a bit. I've got a couple guests in studio, and I'm like, yes, I do carry my Constitution. I got my Virginia Constitution. I carry the thing with me wherever I go. We've been talking about the really lack of compassion and where it comes from. And I want to be clear. Racism, homophobia, xenophobia, you know, mistrust of foreigners, and that's as old as, 400-year history of this country where white people came in, took the land owned by Native Americans, and said, we belong here. So I don't mean to claim that Donald Trump invented all these isms. But I do think he is exacerbating them. I think he is allowing them to come to the forefront. And I think he's openly doing policies that are just simply cruel. And I wonder if in all the hubbub of all the ridiculous inanity of this administration, if we're simply being cruel. And I wonder if they know that showing no cameras in these facilities is purposely designed so that people don't know how cruel we're being. David is calling from San Francisco, California, line 3. Hey, David, how are you?
Well, thanks, Mark. You remember, what was his name? He was, he only died a couple of years ago, but he was a famous columnist, I think for the Washington Post. He wrote the first book about the, the right to self-incrimination, the right to take the Fifth Amendment. I'll think of his name in a minute. Before he died, he was talking about... the Constitution.
Lewis? I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's right. Anthony Lewis. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, he wrote about that cruel and unusual, you know, that's written into the Constitution.
Eighth Amendment.
You're supposed to be protected from cruel and unusual. And so punishment. Anthony Lewis wrote, and this was after 9/11, about the rise of intentional cruel and trying to change the definitions of cruel and unusual.
I think you actually make a really good point. I think it may be that separating children from their parents particularly, you know, when they're just coming here seeking asylum, is a cruel and unusual punishment. It may be an Eighth Amendment violation. I think that's a really good point.
Well, it's, you know, in the history of the world, I mean, it's a pretty rare thing to have all of the children rounded up and taken away. I mean, this is something straight out of, you remember, killing the firstborn when Jesus was around.
Well, I mean, separating children from parents in the Holocaust as well. It's again, they're not killing the kids, but just the sheer lack of compassion. I mean, you know, And I try to be careful about Nazi comparisons because obviously it never rises to that. But
well, sure it is, but, because of Trump's Nazi ties. His dad.
But I think of the Nazi camp guards who would take a baby and smash its head against the wall, who would rip a child from her mother and then, you know, wring her neck and kill her right there in front of her mother. Do these barbaric acts to children, and then they would go home to their own children and love their own children and take them out for ice cream. And there were German kids that said, how could my father be a monster? He was always really nice to me. And they probably were nice to their kids. But it all has to do with this separation of, that's not me. The Jews, they're vermin, or the homosexuals, or the gypsies.
Right,
they're not human. Therefore, you know, I can crush an ant and still love my family. So if I see a human being the same as I see a bug, then, you know, then I have no cognitive dissonance between my cruelty and my lack of cruelty.
Sure. I have in the bigger picture, I personally think much of this all has to do with the prevention of crossing borders, the prevention for the common man to travel the world, in these days of NAFTA and GATT, where we're supposed to make a world's economy, we're supposed to lower the world's barriers.
The European Union has virtually no borders.
Right, yeah, you could walk from Portugal to Moscow.
To Greece. to Moscow. They're not part of the EU. But yes, you could walk to Poland.
Sure, yeah, and the whole idea that that we would be able to travel the world as free men rather than be terrified by, you know, fake fear-mongering and profiteering fear-mongering. So what I'm wondering about with these children, and, you know, the newer reports are saying it's tens of thousands of kids that are rounded up.
Yes, it is.
So the idea that they're putting them into these camps that are no doubt privatized. So the tracking method has to be with the billing. And if one of these privatized agencies is running an account on these kids and they lose track of them, we need to put together a punishment billing so that if you lose track of one of these kids, if it's going to cost the taxpayers 20 times more money to find where these kids are, then we should be able to punish these privatized companies 20 times for the actual costs.
I hear you, David, and I agree with you. I'm going to have to take a break, and we can get back to more of this after the break. But I think you raise a larger point that's really important. When you profit from the abuse, you're more likely to do the abuse. And that's true whether it's these guardians that I'm talking about, whether it's these private agencies, whether it's private prisons or private holding cells for children. One of the reasons why privatizing is so dangerous is because their allegiance is to the dollar and not to the human being. We'll be right back after this. Rusev's Nerdscape. It's Mark Levine. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Where is the lack of compassion? Whether it's to children forcibly separated from their parents simply for seeking asylum, simply for following the dictates of Emma Lazarus's poem, at the base of the Statue of Liberty, give me your tired, your poor, huddled masses yearning to be free. Why are they being punished? Where's the compassion for victims, survivors of sexual assault who say, me too, me too, I was abused? Why are they singled out? Is it because the men who don't want to believe their stories might feel their own guilt? You know, it seems to me that when we hear a story of a crime or a wrong or just any action being done, We as human beings have a tendency to identify with someone. I would hope that most of us in humanity would identify with the victim, with the survivor, with the person who did nothing wrong but suffered from some kind of oppression, whether it's sexual violence or whether it's being separated from your families. But sometimes I think people, probably more unconsciously than consciously, empathize with the perpetrator, right? If you're a white guy, you may not think about the suffering of an immigrant if you're a citizen. If you're a man, some men just can't put themselves in the shoes of a woman who suffered from sexual assault. Who we identify with matters. And if your response to the Me Too movement is, wait a minute, they could accuse me, then maybe you're not, maybe you've done some things. I don't know. To me, it's, look, can people make false accusations? People tell me all the time, but Mark, people can make false accusations. And that's true. People can make false accusations. Every now and then there is a false accusation. It happens. It happened in the Duke Lacrosse case. It happened with Tawana Brawley. But those are the exceptions, not the rule. Every month I attend in Arlington what they call the Rally Against Rape, which isn't a rally at all. It's a massive therapy session that I highly recommend if you live in Northern Virginia. It's the last Thursday in April. And I hear story after story after story. And 90% of the people telling the story are young women between the ages of 15 and 25. Yes, 15. There are some young girls telling these stories. And it's never a stranger. Rarely are the stories the stranger came in my window. Those happen. But usually it's that guy I thought was so nice, a guy I dated the fraternity party. It was my step uncle. It was at a family gathering and my mom didn't believe me. It's usually someone that someone thinks they can trust, which to me makes the crime all the more horrible. I mean, it's terrible to be raped by a stranger, don't get me wrong. But isn't it even worse to be raped by someone you once trusted, to be betrayed? And again, 80, 90% of these stories that I've heard, and I've heard hundreds of them now, are not reported to authorities, not reported to police. Some of these young women might tell one of their friends. Sometimes they might tell their parents. Sometimes they're not believed. And when they do go to the police, they're often given the third degree. All I would ask is that and this is one of the things that I'm doing as an elected official, talking with police and prosecutors and Commonwealth attorneys, district attorneys, it seems to me that a victim of any crime has the right to be believed unless proven a liar. You know, we have this idea in the criminal justice system, which is true, that you're innocent until proven guilty. And no question, to put someone in jail, you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So in preparing a survivor for trial, yeah, you got to ask her tough questions. You got to prepare her for cross-examination. But I'm not talking about trial here. I'm talking about the initial painful reporting. And I think when someone, whether you're in a position of authority or just a friend, just a family member, if someone comes to you and tells you an awful story of what happened to them, listen. Listen with a compassionate ear. That's really all they're asking at first. And yeah, if 1 in 100 times the story doesn't mesh up and you think someone's not telling the truth, okay, you're a human being. You can catch people in a lie. People do lie. But most of the time they don't. Most of the time when telling these stories, they are telling the truth. It seems like the first woman to accuse Bill Cosby was assumed to be a liar. And the second one, probably a liar too. And the third one, well, maybe we're not so sure. And then the fourth, and then the fifth, and then the sixth, and the seventh, and the eighth. And by the time you get to 17, there can be no question that they've all told the truth. But the first one, that takes real courage. These are powerful people. And one of the things that I've themes that I've noticed in this lack of compassion. Part of it is if you make money by not being compassionate, if you profit or incentivize to not have compassion, that leads to lack of compassion. The other is a simple sense of power. If you think, I'm too powerful. I'm above the law, as our president might say when he said this week that he could pardon himself. When his lawyer, Giuliani, said he could shoot Jim Comey dead and face no consequences, no criminal consequences. When you think you're above the law, you're more likely to commit these kinds of crimes, and you're less likely to have compassion. My friends, it's not just 17 stories we've heard about Bill Cosby. It's 17 stories we've heard about Donald Trump. Have we forgotten all these women already? Story after story after story, one on a plane, one on a bus. Have we forgotten already? And no Republicans out there, I'm not giving Bill Clinton a pass either. He was completely tone deaf in the way he responded to questions about Monica Lewinsky today. So I'm not even trying to be ideological here. I'm just saying that powerful people, and usually it's powerful men, and usually it's powerful white men, some of them feel a sense of entitlement that leads to this lack of compassion. Now, if you're thinking, well, hey, I'm a white man and I have compassion, my question for you is, why are you so defensive? I'm a white guy too. Yeah, I'm Jewish and I'm gay, but technically I'm a white guy. I don't feel defensive for these questions. I'm asking these questions. If you feel defensive, ask yourself why you feel defensive and not compassionate. It's an important question. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. I got Julian in studio who wanted to talk online. So Julian often calls in, but this time you're in studio. Welcome, Julian.
Mark, hi, and thanks very much for inviting us. It's
my pleasure.
Pleasure and an honor to be here with you. But look, as always, you, when I speak to you, you've generally moved on to another segment or another
aspect. That's okay. Let's go
so
back.
Can I go back? Can
sure,
I go
let's talk
back
about the children.
I wanted to go back to the question of dehumanizing people. There's a thread of American history where, you know, you see it with a nativism, anti-immigrant sentiment. The immigrants are depicted as monsters crawling out of the swamp. There's that famous cartoon from the 1840s of Irish immigrants depicted as monsters crawling out of the swamp. Japanese were depicted as monkeys during the war.
All of them. The Germans, the Italians, the Jews, Latinos today. Yeah. I mean, when Donald Trump says, that, you know, Mexican sins, it's, you know, they're rapists. Mm. And it's like, I don't even think of Latinos as rapists. Who comes up with this? I mean, any culture can have rapists within it, of course. I don't. It's not even a stereotype that I'm aware of. So it's you're right. It's all about dehumanizing as a way to let us be less than compassionate toward them. I think it's intentional.
Yeah, you have those famous films by Goebbels, in which Jews were depicted as rats.
That's right.
And that's a very, very powerful image.
It is. And it again goes to this idea of the Nazi war criminal who could murder children in the morning and go home to his children in the evening. I'll tell you, there's a really powerful book. It's called Hitler's Willing Executioners by Daniel Goldhagen.
Read it.
He's actually my advisor at Harvard. But that's not why I read his book. I read his book because he was just a powerful book. And in that book, what he does so amazingly is he weaves in primary evidence in his story. And there's one photo that to me tells more than the whole book. You know, a picture is worth a thousand words. There's a postcard. It's a postcard of a German soldier. And he's smiling as he points his rifle at a woman, a naked woman holding a baby. Mm. And he's shooting that child. And he's smiling as he's shooting the child and the woman behind the child. And what it is, it's a postcard. And on the back of the postcard, it's a letter to his girlfriend saying, you know, here I am working hard on the front. It's an astonishing document. It's just an astonishing. I mean, it's like you take the inhumanity of shooting a mother and child to an even a higher level of inhumanity that you almost think unimaginable. Yeah. And it's because, yes, if that woman and child to you is like a rat and you have no problem killing a rat, then it allows this to happen. I agree with you.
And let's remember, in that book, we're not talking about SS execution squads.
No,
we're talking about police
ordinary people. That's exactly right.
Guys who were recruited from the Hamburg police, middle-aged family guys, and they treated Jews as inhuman.
In fact, the full title of the book, as I recall, is Hitler's willing executioners. Ordinary people in the Holocaust, because there was this idea that they were just following orders. All these people weren't following orders; they were actively and joyfully murdering.
Yeah,
and I just wonder, when I hear John Kelly, for example, Mark, let's play that clip of John Kelly talking about this.
Family separation stands as a pretty tough deterrent.
Could be a tough deterrent. A much faster turnaround on asylum seekers.
Even though people say that's cruel and heartless to take a mother away from her children.
Yeah, I think cruel and heartless, I wouldn't put it quite that way. The children will be taken care of.
Yeah.
They'll put into foster care, whatever.
They'll be put into foster care, whatever. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. They don't matter. They don't matter. They're foreign-born children. They don't. It's not like they're humans deserving of love, compassion, attention. They'll be put into foster care, whatever. We'll throw them away somewhere.
Another powerful image, Mark, are the Border Patrol agents who go through the desert finding caches of water that have been left behind by well-wishers to save lives.
That's right.
And these guys take glee in removing the water.
That's right. That's right. They take glee in the thought that these helpless, hopeless people will die in the desert. Mm. That's a good law for me. If I ever get to Congress, that's a good law for us to talk to our elected representatives about. Hey, that's a good law for you to talk to your elected representatives about. Make it a crime to pour out that water, because people do go out in the desert. Mm-hmm. They do provide the water. I'm thinking of the Underground Railroad and the slaves on the way to freedom, where people had way stations. And I don't see how this is any different from that. It was illegal, by the way. It was illegal for slaves to escape. If you're a law and order guy, right? It was legal to whip the slaves. It was legal to rape the slaves. It was illegal to help them escape. So don't give me this, they're illegal immigrants. Yes, it is illegal to help these families escape poverty and oppression. But is it immoral?
I thought it was very...
It's moral.
I thought it was very revealing when Trump called... immigrants animals.
Yeah, it was. Before we go out of the hour, I do want to play the clip from Senator Jeff Merkley, who is struggling to find these children who've been separated from their parents, who are warehoused. He's a United States senator, and they refuse him access to the building. Mark, let's play the clip.
It's at the center at McAllen Border Station. This is the processing center. Earlier, and I was admitted there, and I did see hundreds of children locked up in cages there at that facility. The situation is that they claim, we know exactly where the children are. They all have an A number, they call it, A for alien, and we just look in the computer and we can find them. And when I pushed them on this and said, that doesn't seem to be the experience of anyone who's actually working in the system, they said, no, it's a very, very, very good system. And this is my concern here is that our government is just completely whitewashing the challenges. They lose track of where people are, but they don't want to admit it. They're treating children cruelly in ways that are just totally inappropriate, and then say that they're trying to help the children. This is not the America we know and love.
Senator, just to be clear, you recently saw children in cages?
Yes.
When?
Yesterday morning at the McAllen Border Station at the processing center. They have big cages made out of fencing and then wire and nets stretched across the top of them so people can't climb out of them.
Hundreds of children locked up in cages, notified by number, not even by name. At least prisoners usually have a name. Makes me think of Jean Valjean, Les Miserables, 24601. He's a number, not a man. This is happening today. This is happening in America. This is happening because of a ridiculous, archaic electoral college system combined with Vladimir Putin's interference in our elections, combined with a whole bunch of Americans that didn't vote or voted for a third party. It is partly our fault. Yes, the majority of Americans didn't choose this president, but enough of us did that's causing this cruelty to occur. And the question will be in November of 2018, do we rise up as a nation and reclaim the values that America stands for? Or are we going to sit there as the land of the free and the home of the brave becomes the land of the caged and the home of the cruel? 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. I'll be right back right after this.
He's a Bible-quoting, Constitution-loving, flag-waving, red-blooded, liberal America. He's Mark Levin. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levin.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I've got two callers on the line and a comment on Facebook, and only about 3 minutes left, so I'm going to try to do what I can. I actually think the most interesting comment is made on Facebook by Tristan Shields. He is a former Democratic candidate for the House of Delegates, wonderful young man whom I know well in a very, very tough Republican district. But he asks whether these two issues, immigration and guns, which we didn't discuss this week, but we've discussed lots of other weeks, are the wedge issues for Republicans? Are these the issues that sort of separate the Trump folk from traditional Republican folk? I guess I see them differently. I think they cut different ways. I think you find Republicans that are completely uncompromising on guns but have some compassion for immigrants. And you have people who are completely uncompromising on immigrants but believe in sensible gun control. So I think they do cut differently. But in terms of this issue, immigration, I think that prior to Donald Trump, these positions were seen largely as anathema in both parties. Republicans occasionally talked about illegal immigration, but they never really attacked legal immigrants that I can remember till Donald Trump. And there was a whole bunch of Republicans who supported immigration reform. John McCain, for example. I remember back in the Bush years when they could get 15, 20 votes in the Senate for immigration reform. And Republicans were reaching out to new immigrants, whether they be Latino or South Asian or wherever. So I think this is something new and old at the same time. As Julian points out, nativism, anti-immigrant feeling. Well, I mean, you can go back to, being against Catholics in Maryland, being against the Irish in Germany in the 1840s, Jews and Italians, turn of the century, Latinos today. So anti-immigrant feeling is old. But I think after the Holocaust, after World War II, after people saw the dangers, because remember, we turned away Jewish refugees. We sent those ships back to Germany, back to gas chambers. I think there was such a revulsion that it was understood that America would be the land of refugees. And we might complain about, when I say we, I don't mean me, but I mean some Americans might complain about Mexicans taking our jobs. Which is always silly to me, given that the jobs the Mexicans took tend to be the lowest paying, least wanted jobs, things like, you know, working in the farm country, very tough work. But it seems to me that general hatred of immigrants, I can't really recall it much in my lifetime. Maybe Pat Buchanan, maybe. There was this neo-right. But Donald Trump has brought it out like a cockroach from under a rock. I think he's taking this lack of compassion, and he's remaking the Republican Party in his image. And Republicans are going to have two choices. They can either stick with their traditional Republicanism, which I don't support for a bunch of other reasons, but at least have compassion toward our immigrants, or they have to join the nativism, racism, which is Trumpism. Trumpism is racism, and it's up to Republicans to decide what side they're on. This is Mark Levin signing off.